Eetris on Ringjoon, välispoliitikat uuriv saade, mille toovad teieni rahvusvaheliste suhete ringi noored.
Good evening, dear audience. You're listening to Ringjoon. It's 8 o'clock and it's the beginning of yet another show. Today's show is going to be in English because we have a guest from Argentina. I am Anna Linda. In the studio with me, we also have Randon and our today's guest, Leonardo Patacini. Maybe you can introduce yourself and tell us why you're here.
Okay. Good evening. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's very nice to be here. As you said, my name is Leonardo Patacini. I am from Argentina, and I'm here doing a postdoc research stay at the University of Tartu, Faculty of Social Sciences. So, and being there, I had the big pleasure to receive this invitation, and I thought it would be very nice to come and to discuss some issues we have for today.
So today's topics are pretty difficult. First, we have the topic of the Falkland Islands and comparing with Crimea. And second topic is the structural reforms in the 90s in both Latin America and in Eastern Europe. But we're going to start with the Falkland Islands. And my first question is about the name of the islands, which can be quite controversial because in Spanish it's not Falkland at all. And maybe you can talk about that a bit.
Yeah, actually that's one of the situations we have in Argentina. I would say in South America, the islands are called Malvinas Islands instead of Falkland Islands. And actually the name has a long story, and it came from a long road from French presence in the island in 18th century. The thing is, when French were there, it actually belonged to Spanish Kingdom. So the Spanish Kingdom pressed French to change the name. And the Spanish way of this name was Malvinas. The original name was Malouines or something like that. I'm sorry for my French. So, yeah, actually, when... one of the things that we were discussing before is, okay, how can we call them? It's Malvinas, which is the name I'm used to, and I was taught, and in a way I consider proper, or Falklands, which is the most known name. So I decided to call them the islands just to be as politically correct as possible in this sense. And actually, one thing that we were mentioning before is some years ago, around 10, maybe 15 years ago, there was some kind of fake documentary about the islands. And instead of Falklands, it was Argentinian documentary. It was called Falklands. So the funny thing about that is that every time someone mentions the English name, I immediately tend to think in this banner, which not so polite, look. But I decided to call them the islands to avoid any kind of, politically incorrect problem.
But the islands nowadays are quite a controversial topic in Argentinian policies. For example, as much as I've heard, the Brits usually don't talk about them that much. Maybe it's a policy that they don't usually cover that much. But as I understand, in Argentina, it's something that appears and reappears almost every year when it comes to, and it's also used in the local media as well. I don't know, is it really that popular?
Yeah, actually with the islands, we have two topics, which actually it's interesting to mention. Okay, the first one, and the island topics is very painful for these two reasons. The first reason was the war itself. I mean, the conflict with Britain was very painful, and it was a deep tragedy in Argentinian history. And the thing is that also after the war, the conflict, there were very controversial issue with soldiers who were involved in the war. I mean, actually, most of them didn't receive the status of soldiers. So it's a topic that is raised almost every year. But these people who were not recognized as such. And the main thing is that they are not receiving any kind of pension. I mean, they are not receiving any kind of support because of that. And actually, there are a lot of association of these people who are climbing to be recognized as soldiers in the conflict. So it is like a very controversial issue in these two senses, on the foreign affair aspect, but also as an internal issue that local people are rising every year when the date comes closer.
I'm just wondering listening about the Mark documentary and about the nickname, the Falkland Islands, I just can't get the name out of my head as well. So sorry. Just a question. I have this I got this negative ring when hearing this nickname. Is it really something that the people have just had enough, or it's just it has. Become a bit tiring hearing about the Falkland Islands or just islands. Is it still a real presence of this mentality that these islands really belong to us and we have to get them back?
Yeah. To be honest, that depends a lot on the different political moments. For some governments, it became like a main topic and the main goal on foreign policy, and for some other governments, it became just like a something else in the agenda, but not one of the main things. So depending a little bit on who is in office, it will be different, the emphasis they will put on this topic. And one very important thing to mention is that the conflict was a bit over 30 years ago. And so many of the people who fought in the war, I mean, they were teenagers. They were 18, 20 years old in 1982. So now they are 50. So they are very young, and we are seeing them every day. For example, some years ago, 2 years ago, a very good friend of mine took a taxi, and he started to talk to the taxi driver, and he was a former. He went to fight to the Malvinas War, and he was telling his story. Frequently you just come across these kind of stories and topics, and you know someone who fought, or you know someone who lost someone in the war. Mm-hmm. So it's something that still is very fresh, and I would say that despite this political place for the government. It still has a lot of social entity for Argentinian society, because it's something that you are seeing almost every day.
But we know how the Falkland or the Malvinas topic is discussed in politics. We see what they say about it on BBC or CNN, but how is it discussed in, I don't know, public schools, for instance, or homes?
Well, that's very interesting. For example, we have the Military March of Malvinas, which is the name in Spanish, in which and we are, we have to sing the song in primary school. And the song is saying that even though they are very far, they're in a very cold, distant sea, we'll not forget about these islands and so on. But it's interesting, and every year when April 2, which is the date when the war started, it's a national holiday, and there are usually there are some acts or events in schools in which they remember this date. There is not much discussion about it in school. I mean, it's when you go to primary or secondary school in Argentina, you just know that Malvinas are supposed to be Argentinian, that the British pirates only came and took it, but you don't know exactly what happened, because it's a very controversial issue, and there are a lot of discussion about what really happened there. If you listen to British version of the history and you listen to Argentinian version of the history are completely different, but completely different. So it is very hard to bring this discussion in school. So mostly it's just a very assertive concept that, okay, they belong to Argentina. We have to sing this song every year, but there is no much discussion further. And that's something that I think would be very, very interesting to bring in the next years for younger generations, I think. I think, once again, why there is this lack of discussion? In the first place, I think due to the international level, but also because of this internal conflict. I mean, what is the meaning of the people who went and fight there? What does it mean? Who are they? Why they are recognized or not? So I think that this makes the topic very complicated, and that's why there is not such a deep discussion in Argentinian society about it.
But it's actually changing nowadays because you have the new UN resolution. You had a special committee that was formed to actually increase the maritime territory of Argentina, and now suddenly it was increased. I do have to apologize. I already forgot the number, but it was a substantial increase in the overall territory of Argentina. So but now suddenly, but you have to, you have the, you actually now have even more necessary means to have this topic reemerge, and actually really have this possibility to, even if not to get the islands back, but still to control the area around them. And that's, as far as I've understood, there's also some kind of economic benefit to that as well. They found oil there. Well, of course.
Yeah. That's I would say the main argument in Argentinian claims on the islands. The thing is that the islands are lying in Argentinian waters. Very recently, actually, it was ratified in March of this year. The UN has a special commission on the limits of continental shelf, and they ratify that the islands are in the Argentinian sea platform. Mm-hmm. So the territory, I mean, the waters belong to Argentina. So that would be the main argument for Argentinian claim mm-hmm. on the islands. The thing is that since the war, war was in 1992, as I said before. Since the war, Britain is keeping the exclusive economic zone. It means that they, you know, if you have some island legally recognized, you have some special sphere in which you can have the exclusive economic activities. Right. The thing is that it's not the case of Malvinas. Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, now there are oil exploitation there. Mm-hmm. Actually, there is a lot of oil extraction in different points, some offshore platforms near to the islands. And the thing is, actually, that according to UN resolutions, that mm-hmm. could not be allowed mm-hmm. because, you know, for territories under conflict, UN suggest not to take any action before the problem is solved. The thing is, of course, Britain is one of the countries in the Security Committee, so it has more influence than Argentina, of course. And also, there are military bases in the islands. Britain has a float, which is all the time Navy, around the islands. So the only option for Argentina is just claiming in UN and waiting some kind of resolution. I mean, the other option would be war, but that's absolutely not an option in any way. Actually, that's something that could be interesting to mention. I remember I've been reading during the Crimean crisis that in some British media that Russia was trying to promote some kind of Argentinian military intervention in the islands. That's absolutely non-true. I mean, that's not an option. And in the first place, because there was a very recent traumatic experience, and Argentina will not go again through that. Mm-hmm. And in the second place, because it's absolutely not possible. I think that all Argentinian army can fit in this studio, radio studio, because it's after some terrible experiences with Argentinian army, there is no compulsory military involvement. Mm-hmm. So the number of people in the army is, I don't know, maybe hundreds, but I mean, it's really, I mean, that's one of the good things about being so far from the rest of the world, that most probably no one will try to attack you there. And if they are coming, you will see them coming with some time. So, yeah. And I would say we have good relationship with the neighbors, so that it doesn't look to be a problem in the next month, at least. So the thing is, why was I trying to say? So military intervention is absolutely not an option now in the current context. And actually, I would say that Argentina is not really discussing, or Argentinian goal should not be discussing the nationality mm-hmm. of the people living in the islands, because that's a different topic and it's far more complex. Argentina is more trying to discuss sovereignty on economic issues. Actually, this year in May, I mean, a few months ago, they just discovered a huge
reservoir.
Bug. In Spanish, it's the translation is bug, but yeah, reservoir. Mm-hmm. And actually, as I said, that should not be allowed, but it's happening. And actually, they are extracting the oil. So the idea is mostly to discuss some kind of share cooperation in economic issues. Yeah. The issue of nationality of people living in the island, I think it's completely different. And in that sense, I think that they, that's a different topic in which I think that they should have their own opinion, and but that's called democracy, so it's fine. but for example, actually this week Britain started some military training there, and they will try some missiles. So it's not very polite if you know a territory under dispute. Mostly I would say that the main thing right now is the economic benefits that the islands can bring. Yeah.
So I think that now that we know a lot about the situation from the Argentinian side of the Falkland and the Malvinas, so we promised our public that we will compare it with Crimea. So I think first we should go on a musical break. I will play the song that Leonardo, the hymn that Leonardo mentioned, the marcha that children in primary schools have to sing. So we will be back after a short break.
De aquellos horizontes
Eetris on Ringjoon, välispoliitika tuuriv saade, mille toovad teieni rahvusvaheliste suhete ringi noored.
So we are back from our break. This was the Malvinas march that we mentioned earlier. And now I think we can discuss about the topic comparing to Crimea.
Yeah, the possible relations. I would like to start off with after the annexation of the Crimea, the tabloids, all kinds of newspaper headlines were in Great Britain were quoting David Cameron and all kinds of other members of the cabinet, asking, you know, comments about it, and they said, well it's preposterous, it's something we should never allow, it's Russia exceeding its borders or its limits. So but afterwards there was an immediate response from the Russian politicians comparing Crimea with the Falklands, saying that well, we need the Crimea more than you need the Falklands. And as we were talking about, you know, the economic benefits, and actually you were saying that there's actually a military base there, a naval base in the Falklands, then one of the reasons also why Russia would actually want to have the Crimea was to get access to the ports, you know, in Sevastopol. So, and it's just something that, you know, immediately created a connection between those two cases. In my opinion, it is kind of so, because if I think about it pure in a pragmatic way, it seems that Russia does have a bigger right to own the Crimea than Britain has over the Falklands, because let's be honest. When I've read about the history, I'm not sure if I'm saying this correctly, but after the Spanish had left, the British just came and seized the islands. And but after the independence, Argentina should have gotten the islands for themselves, as because they were part of Spanish territory. But Crimea was just given, or as a present, by Nikita Khrushchev, who was Ukrainian himself, to the Ukraine. So do you think this comparison is justified?
Well, actually, the comparison started in a very interesting way, because in 2013, in March, Britain tried to use the ultimate argument to say that the islands were British or they belonged to Britain, organizing a referendum, asking the islanders if they wanted to belong to Britain or to Argentina. Yeah. I mean, they didn't say Argentina. So do you want to be part of Britain or not? Well, result was 99.8. Actually, literally, they received only 3 votes against being part of Britain. and in a way, I mean, I think that it's normal. And, if you... trying to forget about my nationality for a while, if you are offered to have British or Argentinian nationality, well, yeah, it's not the same passport. That's absolutely clear. And another thing to take into consideration is that Britain has a presence in the islands for over 180 years. So in that sense, many generations of islanders have been living there in a row. So I totally... The language there is English. I mean, everything is... You go there and you feel like in Britain, a bit farther, but it's totally British. Environment is totally British. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, that it's totally understandable. But the thing is that exactly 1 year later, in March 2014, there was this referendum in Crimea, in which Crimeans voted... Okay, before they declared independence, they voted to join Russia, and then the thing was that Britain, as most of Western countries, they raised their voice, saying that, of course, that was not legal, that the referendum was not binding, and that could not be allowed. It was illegal. Mm-hmm. And then that's when the main question comes up, which is, okay, when referendums are legal, when you say that they are legal, then it's like playing football with someone who wants to be the referee in the middle of the match. And so in that sense, that's when the comparison started. And actually, that was an interesting connection in diplomatic terms between Argentina and Russia, in which both they're saying, okay, but then you have a double standard for these kind of issues. I mean, mm-hmm. when you organize the referendum, it's legal. When someone else organized the referendum, it's illegal. Yeah. So it is, in a way, it's interesting because both Argentina and Russia are supposed to be affected by these double standards. Mm-hmm. The thing is that it's a very interesting balance because what could be good for one would be very bad for the other. I mean, if referendums are not legal, then Argentina loses. Russia loses, and if referendums are legal, Russia wins, but Argentina loses. So it's very good. I mean, both have the right to be against that. It's hard to understand what could be good for both at the same time. But in any case, the thing is that after this referendum, the comparison started. However, there are very important differences between Crimea and islands. Mm-hmm. In the first term, population. In Crimea live over 2 million people, in the islands less than 20,000. Yeah. So, the history. Yeah, as we know, Crimea has been part of Russia for hundreds of years. Then it went to Ukraine during the USSR time, in which they were supposed to be part of the same country, and as you mentioned, in this very strange movement, and then, you know, most of the population living in Crimea are from Russian background, so it's a bit different in that sense, because people living in the islands in South Atlantic, they are mostly from British backgrounds. Mm-hmm. How did British got there? I mean, how did they get there? As you said, the islands used to belong to Spanish Kingdom. Mm-hmm. When Argentina declared independence, I mean, many things happened in between, but very briefly, when Argentina declared independence in 1816, mm-hmm. The islands were inherited by the new independent Argentinian government. 5 years later, Britain recognized Argentinian independence, and it didn't claim the islands.
Okay. Yeah.
So what is the thing? Well, when Napoleonic Wars finished and Britain became the workshop of the world, and after in British Industrial Revolution and trade became much more important, the Strait of Magellan in the south, mm-hmm. of Argentina and Chile was one of the shortest way. I mean, there were only two ways to get to southern East Asia, which was through the Cape of Good Hope or the Strait of Magellan. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, the islands were absolutely critical in geopolitical terms because it was the entrance of this strait. And in economic and trade terms, they were absolutely essential for British interest. Mm-hmm. So in 1833, Britain went, and I mean, there was a military invasion, mm-hmm. which it wasn't a war because I don't know how many people were in the island and it was impossible to resist. So they just say, okay, we are taking the islands. Okay, we cannot do anything. They just went back to Argentina. There was a very small Argentinian settlement in the islands. So since then, since 1833, they have been over British rule. Mm-hmm. And they remained under British rule until 1982, when there was the military intervention by Argentinian government, which it is very important to say that it was the most stupid, self-destructive and criminal decision that government could ever take. I mean, it was a military dictatorship that literally sent the boys to die there. I mean, they were not equipped, they were not trained, they didn't have weapons, they starved, they froze. I mean, the situation itself is unbelievable. And they took over the islands for, I don't know, 5 days, and apparently they thought that Britain will not respond to this aggression, which was this, and of course Britain decided to respond, and then the war started and lasted for 2 months. So in that sense, the history of the islands are more more eclectic in the relationship between Argentina and Britain if you compare to Crimea. Yeah. I mean, it's in a sense this idea that Lavrov, Sergei Lavrov, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia said, okay, we have more right to Crimea than you have to the islands. It's a strong argument. It's a strong argument. Even though the manners are completely polemic, but in that sense, that argument seems to be pretty strong. Yeah.
It's just the thing is the thing that two of those instances have in common is the fact that, in my personal opinion, both parties who decided to have a referendum. Well, I'm pretty sure they were convinced that they were going to win. So basically, the British, as you said, the whole population of the islands is British, and in Crimea, I think at that time it was, it should still be about this, about the same, is about 60% Russian, and there were also also native Ukrainians, Crimean, how's the name in English? Tatars, yeah, and well, it was quite unimaginable. Well, they say that there was Russian intervention during the elections. Of course, there were no any observers that were allowed to view the local elections there, but still, I think even this kind of intervention from Russia wasn't really necessary because they would have won anyway. So. But an interesting point with the Falklands is that there was a military regime in Argentina at that time, and well, they were spiraling that to grasp political influence. But after the Falklands, it was after this military disaster, they completely lost influence, and after about a year, had to give up their power. But this is an interesting period in South American history, because a lot of regimes started to collapse around that time, and which, you know, paved the way for market reforms and neoliberalism, and there were also some new populist leaders, if I do remember correctly, then Argentina had positive results. Initially, at first, with the reforms, with market liberalization, that's a tongue twister. But in the end, after the 90s, it kind of fell apart. Nowadays, it's not very beneficial to be a neoliberal in the political landscape of Argentina. Or how would you say?
Okay. In the first place, something that you mentioned, which is also important to mention, is that the decision to go to invade or recover the islands from Argentina was taken by a military dictatorship. Actually, I think in this sense it was similar to the situation in Crimea, that the person who decided to invade the islands used to take 2 liters of scotch per day. So yeah, General Galtieri was a well-known drunk person. So we consider that only in that conditions you can take such a decision. So that in the first, yeah, it was a decision in the last stage of desperation, because they were losing all. I mean, they didn't have support, or only from a minority of society. Mm-hmm. The thing was that they were not losing support; they were losing fear. I mean, they were supported by fear, and in the last month, the population was even not fearing them. Mm-hmm. So they decided to make this military intervention as a last attempt to retain power. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was a terrible miscalculation. They lost the war, and that's the consequence. Actually, exactly, I would say a year immediately after the war, there was a change of the person in office, and then they start to organize the transition to elections.
Yeah.
And actually, Malvinas War, Falkland War, was the last step in this falling down. And actually, many things changed in Argentina. For example, I was born exactly 9 months after the end of Malvinas War. There was a baby boom after Malvinas War, and that's very similar. That is very similar to what happened here after the 90s.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I am the first generation born in democracy again, and there was a baby boom after the end of the, you know, when military dictatorship. Okay, we failed, we are leaving, we will organize elections. And something similar happened in Eastern countries after the 90s. I mean, I guess most of people in this room, okay, except me, were born during the 90s after the recovery of independence in Baltic countries. So in that sense, there are some similarities. The main difference, I would say, is that reforms, structural reforms in Central and Eastern Europe started only after the 90s. Mm-hmm. And in South America, well, in Latin America, they started during the military dictatorships. I mean, those reforms could not have been implemented in democracy, because they were totally, totally unpopular, and people would have been totally against those kind of reforms. So they were initially taken by military dictatorships. That was the case of Argentina, of Uruguay, of Chile, Brazil, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Bolivia, Paraguay, etc. All the countries in South America. Why these measures were applied? I mean, what changed that made this possible? There were some traumatic episodes in Latin America, and also, even though in Central Eastern Europe it was not so necessary, because the context was completely different. If you see the 80s, both in Eastern Europe and in Latin America, it was a decade of stagnation. I mean, the economies were totally depressed during these years. Mm-hmm. In the case of Latin America, it is called the lost decade, because the growth was zero. By the end of the decade, it was no growth at all compared to the beginning. In the case of Eastern Europe, it was a long decade of decay for mm-hmm. For the Soviet Union and the centrally planned economies. So in that sense, that was, let's say, loosening the support of the previous models, and the final touch, the final punch in this context was hyperinflation. There were hyperinflations in most of Latin American countries, again, Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, Paraguay, Bolivia, and something very similar happened here in Central and Eastern Europe. There were hyperinflation in Hungary, in Russia, in Bulgaria, in Baltic countries. So I think that was a key factor to promote this kind of changes in both continents. Then if you take a look at these reforms, they were very similar. I mm-hmm. mean, they were inspired, but it was called the Washington Consensus, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which was a set of 10 guidelines of reforms. they were mostly based on three pilars, which were privatization, liberalization, and deregulation. Mm-hmm. It was very similarly applied in both regions.
Yes.
And both regions also suffer, which was called shock therapy. I mean, this idea that you have to implement all reforms as soon as possible because time and support is a scarce resource. I mean, you have to take advantage of it as long as you have it, because soon it will be over. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Central and Eastern Europe, it was easier because the regime was changing and the previous regime didn't have so much support. Mm-hmm. And in some countries like Estonia, like Latvia, like Lithuania, for example, it was seen as an external occupation. Mm-hmm. So it's normal that they wanted to go as far from that as possible. Mm-hmm. In the case of Latin America, it was presented as a necessary change to grow.
Yeah.
You know, after a decade of stagnation, they said, okay, we have to change. I mean, you had stagnations, you had hyperinflation. So the only way to grow now it's
was to make change. Yeah, of course.
And in that context, in the beginning of the 90s, both regions went on with these reforms. Although, as I said, in the case of Latin America, it started earlier with the military dictatorships. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Now this we are gonna go on our last break, and afterwards I hope we'll continue with this stirring discussion. So don't go away, we'll be missing you.
Galtieri took the Union Jack, and Maggie over lunch one day took a cruiser with all hands, apparently to make him give it back.
Eetris on Ringjoon, välispoliitika tuuriv saade, mille toovad teieni rahvusvaheliste suhete ringi noored.
Hello and welcome back. Have you been missing us? Because I've certainly, and we've all missed you. So, we left off with an important discussion about structural reforms, especially in economy, during and also political reforms that took place in the 90s, and how the comparison between South America and Eastern and Central Europe actually could be compared with one another. It is a strange thing because, as you said, in both cases, in both regions, those structural reforms happened in a hurry. People were just trying to find a new way. There was no small or gradual transition, except for some cases. I think Uruguay was one of those who had somewhat of a gradualism or something.
We would say that everything in Uruguay happens very slowly, but that's a good thing, actually.
Yeah, it's one of the things that we had in Estonia was that we had a lot of state-owned farmlands. We call them not kolhoosid and sovhoosid. And the main thing was that after the independence, we decided to privatize them quite quickly. But the problem was that people who actually owned them, they were, I think, third or fourth generation of the people who initially owned those farmlands. But the people who acquired them when they were privatized didn't know what to do with them. And which is why the whole agriculture, it has been said that one of a popular politician in Estonia called Mart Laar was responsible for the downfall of the Estonian agriculture. And which is... but as you were talking about it, I just had, you know, this kind of like revelation, because it was also done in a hurry, because it was all kinds of political movements at that time were just, you know, to distance oneself from the Soviet influence. And as far as I know, actually I wanted to ask you a different kind of question. Do you think that the Washington Consensus and the plans that were implemented weren't necessarily just a part of, you know, the necessary structural reforms that many dictators wanted to implement, but there was also some kind of pressure from the United States or from the countries at that time who were really for those reforms?
Absolutely, yes. I know that this sounds like conspiracy theory, which is
no worries. But everything's allowed here. So.
Okay, besides any possible, you know, stigmatization of this, it's no secret that South American militaries who made this. This push during 70s, 60s, 70s, they were trained in the United States. There was a place called Escuela de las Americas, America School, and they were not only teaching how to organize the governments after taking the power, but also how this kind of models should be implemented.
Yes.
And there is no secret that Milton Friedman, one of the main leaders of the Chicago School.
Mm-hmm.
He was advisor of Augusto Pinochet in Chile. So this connection, they had meetings and there are documents of these meetings. So it's not just a conspiracy theory. If you want to look for a nice argumentation, more detective way, it's a very interesting book by Naomi Klein, The Shock Treatment, which it's more journalism than social sciences, but still has some interesting ideas, some very well documented, some others more discussable. But there was a connection between these structural reforms and the international context.
But what went wrong in that way? Because I think initially they were a bit successful, but in the end they also, the growth in the end, especially on labor economy, labor reforms, it practically didn't do much. That's something that all the South American countries had in common, that actually the labor, the working condition and work productivity didn't grow by much at all. I think there was just even a bigger gap in the end between the highest earners and the lowest. Yeah. So,
and unfortunately, one of the main things still in South America is inequality. One of the main features of Latin American economies are inequality, which is terrible. The thing with these models, this is more like conspiracy theory. it was implemented, I would say, like an experiment in the sense that this never happened before. This kind of structural reforms all together at the same time and in world open economies. The economy has never been so open before in the human history. Opening economies in such a context was the first time experiment. What was the consequence for most of Latin American countries? Well, industries decline. For Argentinian industries, which didn't have such a high productivity, it was impossible to compete with goods coming from United States, from India, from China.
Yeah.
Actually, that was a moment when China was rising, so it was even harder.
Yeah.
And of course, when companies went bankrupt, they just fired the people who were working there. When people are fired, they don't have money to spend. So demand declines. And how can you get out from that? Well, Latin American economies didn't. I mean, the only solution for that was a political solution. It ended up in struggles in most of Latin American economies. Mm-hmm. It was the case of Argentina, 2001, December 2001, 35 people died due to public clashes. Something very similar happened in Bolivia with some internal struggles. Well, in Brazil, it has been also very complicated. Brazil has a different history because due to the role of trade unions there, but also a lot of political conflict and social conflicts. It was the case in Peru. It was the case also in Venezuela. I mean, the features of these reforms were really painful for societies. I mean, this way to open up economies was very painful for societies. Argentina in 1991 had over 20% of unemployment. Oh, and after, in the next years, 2000, 2001, unemployment declined. It didn't decline because more working positions were created, but because people decided not to look for jobs anymore. I mean, it was impossible to find jobs, so they just didn't look. And some of them started to emigrate. Something similar to what happened in Latvia, for example, last year, in a way, in the Baltic states. So, summing up, this model worked when money was coming from abroad. Okay. When money came, mostly when public companies were privatized. Mm-hmm. During the first years, they privatized all the public companies. So money was coming from abroad. Mm-hmm. When you run out of companies to privatize, money is not coming anymore. So that's when problems come. The short-term solution was asking money to IMF. But when the IMF said, I'm not lending you more money, the system collapsed. That was what happened in Brazil in 1999, in Argentina in 2001, and in some other countries almost at the same time.
Okay, but what were the reforms or something that were adopted afterwards? I mean, nowadays you don't have that. Of course, there are no more like market reforms or a neoliberal society. But what does it look like?
No, it's actually that would be another topic, because there was a complete change of direction in 2002, 2003 with the new government, and after 12 years there was another complete change. I mean, now Argentina is coming back to the direction that abandoned in 2001. How is that possible? That's a very good question. But my background is in sociology, but one thing I know that I will never understand is society. So at least I'm trying to have fun with it, trying to make questions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And well, dear audience, it offers me great pleasure to inform you that, unfortunately, our time for today is up. I don't know how it's been for you, but time just flew by here in our little office. But please be sure to visit us at International Society. sorry. It's been a long day. Society of International Relations. Tomorrow at Bahat Boisit, and a very prominent person will be speaking with us. Tomorrow it's Andres Cayo, and well, I hope that your Monday evening will be a pleasant one and joyful, and goodbye. And of course, let's not forget our wonderful speaker, Leonardo.
Thanks a lot for the invitation. It was really wonderful. Mm-hmm.